Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And I need to remind you, we need to continue our appeal to heaven. And in so doing, we need to continue to learn and constantly pray. But more importantly, we need to act. It's that old adage, knowledge is power, but it doesn't become power until we act upon it. On top of that, everything we are doing is full compliance with the Constitution. We're not seeking Second Amendment. You got to adhere to the Second Amendment. Our guns, the right of bearing arms shall not be infringed. No. Then we're turning our back on all the rest of the stuff. Like, stay out of our lives, you know, stay out of our education, on and on and on. So I know people are starting to get this. And so I appreciate that. And I appreciate people doing things, but we need to do more. And if you are ready, if you want to start, and if, especially if you're involved in any way with the party, I know I'm tough on everybody. I'm tough on myself. I was never a cutter. I never cut myself or beat myself or anything like a masochist. But I am tough on myself because I think we need to always have introspect and say, I can do better. How can I do better? And if you're married, then you have a lot of help. Anyway, so welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And so if we're ready to dive into this, we're on page 142. We're covering Mr. Spate's response in some of the comments that were, I believe, made by Mr. Lenore, I think, yeah. Anyway, instead of Karen, we changed the name to Lenore. Right, anyway. And we kind of left off with the no sect is preferred. So let's take it from there. Thank you so much.
All right. No sect is preferred to another. Every man has a right to worship the Supreme Being in the manner he thinks proper. No test is required. All men of equal capacity and integrity are equally eligible to offices. Temporal violence might make mankind wicked, but never religious. A test would enable the prevailing sect to persecute the rest. I do not suppose an infidel or any such person will ever be chosen to any office unless the people themselves be of the same opinion. He says that Congress may establish ecclesiastical courts. I do not know what part of the Constitution warrants that assertion. It is impossible. To no such power is given them. The gentleman advises such amendments as would satisfy him and proposes a mode of amending before ratifying. If we do not adopt first, we are no more a part of the Union than any foreign power. It will be also throwing away the influence of our state to propose amendments as the condition of our ratification. If we adopt first, our representatives will have a proportionable weight in bringing about amendments, which will not be the case if we do not adopt it. It is adopted by 10 states already. The question, then, is not whether the Constitution be good, but whether we will or will not confederate with the other states. The gentleman supposes that the liberty of the press is not secured. The Constitution does not take it away. It says nothing of it and can do nothing to injure it. But it is secured by the Constitution of every state in the Union in the most ample manner.
Okay, so now he dives into the, because if we remember, Mr. Lenore was diving all over the place, and so he covered a few different topics as such, he covered the commission, he also covered the exclusive legislation, slaves, and so forth. So his response on exclusive legislation?
He objects to giving the government exclusive legislation in a district not exceeding 10 miles square, although the previous consent and session of the state within which it may be is required. Is it to be supposed that the representatives of the people will make regulations therein dangerous to liberty? Is there the least color or pretext for saying that the militia will be carried and kept there for life? Where is there any power to do this? The power of calling forth a militia is given for the common defense. And can we suppose that our own representatives chosen for so short a period will dare to pervert a power given for the general protection to an absolute oppression? But the gentleman has gone farther and says that any man who will complain of their oppressions or write against their usurpation may be deemed a traitor and tried as such in the 10-mile square without a jury. What an astonishing misrepresentation. Why did not the gentleman look at the Constitution and see their powers? Treason is there defined. It says expressly that treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Complaining, therefore, or writing cannot be treason. Here, Mr. Lenore rose and said he meant misprision. I'm not sure what that word is. He meant misprision of treason. The same reasons hold against that, too. The liberty of the press being secured creates an additional security. Persons accused cannot be tried without a jury, for the same article provides that the trial of all crimes shall be by jury. They cannot be carried to the 10-mile square, for the same clause adds, and such trial shall be held in the state where the said crimes shall have been committed. He has made another objection that land might not be taxed, and other taxes might fall heavily on the poor people. Congress has a power to lay taxes, and no article is exempted or excluded. The proportion of each state may be raised in the most convenient manner. The census or enumeration provided is meant for the salvation and benefit of the southern states. It was mentioned that land ought to be the only object of taxation. As an acre of land in the northern states is worth many acres in the southern states, this would have greatly oppressed the latter. It was then judged that the number of people, as therein provided, was the best criterion for fixing the proportion of each state, and that proportion in each state to be raised in the most easy manner for the people. But he has stated another objection, which I never heard before, that Congress may call for men in proportion to the number of Negroes. The article with respect to requisitions of men is entirely done away. Men are to be raised by bounty. Suppose it had not been done away. The eastern states could not impose on us a man for every black. It was not the case during the war, nor ever could be, but the quotas of men are entirely done away.
Okay, so he kind of covers kind of a bevy of things, from the exclusive legislation, and I really liked how he kind of jumped off with the fact that he couldn't be, you know, more dramatic than, you know, it gives his misrepresentation of how, you know, he's making these conclusions that the people would be dragged into the District of Columbia without a trial by jury. To me, that's why I correlated the Karen to Lenore. I mean, it was pretty drastic. And, you know, Patrick Henry was a pretty extreme, hyperboil, you know, in every direction. But this guy was really, because at least many of the anti-federalists would actually create some really decent justifications and dive into the details of how. I mean, I remember Mason actually laid out precisely how they would ignore the militia and, you know, the states would be, you know, they'd start creating a standing army. The reality is that when you really look at what they're saying, what they're asserting, like Mason and Henry, Lenore not so much, because he was just making unfounded, without any supporting, you know, arguments or reinforcements to his argument to basically bolster it up. The other gentleman in the anti-federalist camp that actually had good arguments that they were throwing out, those arguments that they used were actually violations of the Constitution. I've said this before. When Mason talked about how they would ignore the disciplining, the training, the equipping of the militia, well, if they ignored it, that means that they're violating the Constitution. They can't ignore it. They have to do those things. The states have to hold them accountable. So, you know, this was the game that they played. Some guys just couldn't connect the dots to create a good argument, and others did. But Mr. Lenore, like I said, he kind of deserves the Karen for the anti-federal, especially in North Carolina. Let's go ahead and do this last paragraph before we go further. Go ahead.
Okay. Another objection which he makes is that the federal courts will have cognizance of contracts between this state and citizens of another state, and that public securities negotiated by our citizens to those of other states will be recoverable in specie in those courts against this state. They cannot be negotiated. What do these certificates say? Merely that the person therein named shall, for a particular service, receive so much money. They are not negotiable. The money must be demanded for them in the name of those therein mentioned. No other person has a right. There can be no danger, therefore, in this respect. The gentleman has made several other objections, but they have been so fully answered and clearly refuted by several gentlemen in the course of the debates that I shall pass them by unnoticed. I cannot, however, conclude without observing that I am amazed he should call the powers of the general government indefinite. It is the first time I heard the objection. I will venture to say they are better defined than the powers of any government he ever heard of.
Yeah, and that's so true, because I can't emphasize enough how the Constitution delegated very specific and defined powers. No government ever on the face of the earth, before the United States and even to this day, has done that. In other words, there's no people that had apparently the common sense to say, hey, you know, that's a brilliant idea. Let's give them only the powers necessary to do the things that we want them to do, and let's keep them from doing the things we don't want them to do, so that we can be happy. And the problem was, there was just this blind trust by the people. They thought that even their states, they thought at least their states were going to safeguard them, that they were going to, you know, ensure that their interests were protected. How little did they know that the federal government was coming with money to coerce them into doing things for them, and basically just perverting the entire process. So,
yeah.
As we kind of jump down now, we're now looking at, let me see here, the abuse of powers by Mr. Iredell. Now, this is all red, so it must be good. And, oh, by the way, a name jumps out at me here. It's Mr. Karen or Mr. Lenore. Go ahead.
All right. The general ground of the objection seemed to be that the power proposed to the general government may be abused. If we give no power but such as may not be abused, we shall give none, for all delegated powers may be abused. There are two extremes equally dangerous to liberty. These are tyranny and anarchy. The medium between these two is the true government to protect the people. In my opinion, this Constitution is well calculated to guard against both these extremes. The possibility of general abuses ought not to be urged, but particular ones pointed out. A gentleman who spoke some time ago, Mr. Lenore, observed that the government might make it treason to write against the most arbitrary proceedings. He corrected himself afterwards by saying he meant misprision of treason. But in the correction, he committed as great a mistake as he did at first. Where is the power given to them to do this? They have power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations. They have no power to define any other crime whatever. This will show how apt gentlemen are to commit mistakes. I am convinced, on the part of the worthy member, it was not designed, but arose merely from inattention.
How about that, huh? How about that? That, in other words, he kind of gave him a graceful way of going, yeah. You idiot, you know?
Yeah, he let him off pretty easy.
So, okay. I mean, like I said, Mr. Lenore really, really got the attention. And, you know, when Iredell did this, I thought, okay, I wish I would have been there. But anyway, all right. So exclusive legislation by Mr. Lenore. Now he's going to kind of throw something else out there. Let's go ahead.
Mr. Lenore arose and declared that he meant that those punishments might be inflicted by them within the 10 miles square, where they would have exclusive powers of legislation.
Ah, okay. So now he's putting a twist on it. However, go ahead. Mr. Iredale talks about these things.
Mr. Iredale continued, they are to have exclusive power of legislation, but how? Wherever they may have this district, they must possess it from the authority of the state within which it lies, and that state may stipulate the conditions of the cession. Will not such state take care of the liberties of its own people? What would be the consequence if the seat of the government of the United States, with all the archives of America, was in the power of any one particular state? Would not this be the most unsafe and humiliating? Do we not all remember that in the year 1783, a band of soldiers went and insulted Congress? The sovereignty of the United States was treated with indignity. They applied for protection to the state they resided in, but could obtain none. It is to be hoped such a disgraceful scene will never happen again, but that for the future, the national government will be able to protect itself. Okay. The powers of the government are particularly enumerated and defined. They can claim no others but such as are so enumerated. In my opinion, they are excluded as much from the exercise of any other authority as they could be by the strongest negative clause that could be framed. A gentleman has asked, what would be the consequence if they had the power of their purse and sword? I ask, in what government under heaven are these not given up to some authority or other? There is a necessity of giving both the purse and the sword to every government, or else it cannot protect the people.
Okay, so I kind of chuckled because he kind of points out, excuse me, that, and actually, to be clear, Mr. Iredell misses a point here. And the point that he misses is that even though there's a secession of the state, If the District of Columbia was going to remain in the middle of a state or on the edge of a state, that state secedes complete control to this general government. The point, really, that I would have made is why, what interest would this general government have in creating a hostile environment for those whom they're there to serve? Now, it's one thing for them to have police and order and being able to, you know, control that Congress should be able to set that. But to be clear, when he goes down this path of talking about, do we not all remember that in the year 1783, a band of soldiers went and insulted Congress? Now, when we're looking at, you know, what happened, okay, that right there was kind of, because the state itself offered no help for Congress. I mean, Congress was, at this point, you know, almost dead. And I say that because the war was over. They were just literally working out peace and everything else. The states, most of the states didn't need or didn't want to have to be, the best way of saying this is that they didn't want to be beholden to some general government. This is why these big states, even though they were part of the Articles of Confederation moving forward from 1783 on, The reason they were fighting this Constitution is because they could ignore Continental Congress, and Continental Congress couldn't do anything. So what's the problem, right? I mean, if you don't care what the heck's happening to Continental Congress and the rest of the states, and you're happy because you've got, you know, you got everything working your way, why would you care? So when we look at this, you know, this comment, and he talks about how these men, because actually, if I remember correctly, after the Constitution was signed, and after, you know, in D.C., there was a ruckus where I believe a lot of soldiers came and said, hey, have you forgotten us? You know, you were supposed to take care of us. And George Washington had to go in and basically say, look, you know, these are hard times. We're trying to do everything we can. Give us time. And he basically, you know, got the guys to dismiss and go on. I don't believe that those two are the same incidents, because I do not believe in 1783 Washington was there. I believe this other incident I'm speaking of was just after the forming in 1789. And... or it may have been actually a little bit later when they actually went down into the Pennsylvania area. Nevertheless, the point is that D.C. needed to have its own measures of protecting itself. But D.C. was not to be a permanent resident. Now, even though you could get elected and you could sit there, it wasn't to be a permanent position for anybody. However, this thing called the necessary and proper, because one of the things that they did, the first thing they did was they created a general service account. And this was a bunch of employees that basically went out and made sure they procured those things necessary, writing, paper, chairs, those types of things for Congress and for the president and for the court. So... They started creating a bureaucracy, which actually created this little, let's call it this little subculture, sub-life of the District of Columbia. Now, when I read through the Land Acts and going up into the Land Act of 1820, this is when they actually started showing what they were doing. They were looking to build schools and I'll just say culturally refined things for entertainment. I mean, D.C. was going to become the town. Even though New York has always been, you know, leagues ahead, just because the demand, the you know, supply, demand, population, all of that was there for the East Coast. And so, and it was one of the close, why was New York the prevalent port instead of further south? Why was New York such a dominating, this dominating opportunity in receiving goods into New York over Norfolk, over a lot of the ports that were south of them? Why is that? Boston, too. Boston was thriving really well, because they were closer. It took less time to get goods to New York than it did to go somewhere else. And so it was just the point of least resistance, or just the closest. So as we kind of look at what was going on in D.C., D.C. was going to become this really culturally refined area. That's what they wanted. These men were... As they started establishing themselves, we had a conversation today in the East Coast leadership meeting where I kind of pointed out, we're going into a break, where I kind of pointed out this opulence and this aristocracy that was literally getting created in America, how the well-to-do people were really doing well, and the poor people were, you know, they were struggling, but they had equal opportunity. Little did everybody know that they were actually working to try to ingratiate themselves. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so there's so many little rat holes, I realize I'm kind of stretching across, but in point, regarding D.C., D.C. was this interesting creation, and we'll get into this with the Assumption Act, right? But when you look at the District of Columbia and its location to Philadelphia, its location to New York, and you look at, again, where D.C. is almost equal distance from New York, almost, down to Richmond, the next really good port area that has easy access into the hinterland, because Delaware and the peninsula becomes a funneling where you have to go all the way up and around to, get commerce, down to South Carolina and so forth. So that's why out on these, I'll just say, these jet outs of the terrain going out where they became kind of trapped, or they were bottlenecks where the commerce had to go to get to anywhere else in the United States, it had to go through this very specific track, like going north and then going south. So with the way they were doing commerce and everything else, there were real reasons why New York was just the preference. And oh, by the way, the other thing is, the reason New York was the preference is because up there, they were actually importing raw goods. And what I mean by that is the northern area was converting to factories, right? So they were bringing in the processed leathers or fabrics, those types of things that were being made so that they could make the clothes, so they could make these things. So the textiles started actually bringing more and more goods up there. What was happening in the ports down in the south? Well, their demand wasn't so high because a lot of people weren't buying those types of clothes and new stuff and so forth. So this creation of where influence money, really, it just landed in the northern part of the United States on the East Coast. And D.C. was going to create, and there was no way they could stop this, by the way, because these guys were the ones with power. So when people came from other nations to actually entreat with the government of the United States, they did it in D.C. So, we got to entertain these people. We got to have, a theater. We have to have, and it got worse and worse. And look at it today. It is the den of iniquity. And so, yeah. It is such a problem. I mean, Trump is finally doing things about that. And I, don't mean to, deviate into this. But the point is when you start looking at, how we migrated and how there were these real efforts over time, and there's still these efforts to create monarchies through corporations. I mean, Bill Gates is a global king through his corporation, and America was the place where they could do these things. So if you read my first book, I talk about how this guy by the name of George Fitzhugh, who was an academic and a professor, arguing that all people, doesn't matter what your color was, if you were not a freeholder, if you didn't have money and education, then you should be a slave. And they believed that creating the statist aristocracy, in contrast to that, Marx was basically trying to create what he thought was a statist for the little man, where the people would be in power. But do the people ever get in power? Look at Russia. The people were never in power. It was still the same people. What happens is the guys that have influence, they have the resources, they get the guns, they need people to fire the guns. So they use, as Lenin would call it, useful idiots to fight the revolution. And as soon as the revolution is done and they win, the people that come in with all the power, resources, and know what to do, they take the guns back, they go kill those people who got them the revolution, and now they have full control. Look at what Pol Pot did. It is always a wake of death when statists take over. And so that was going to happen in America. But fortunately, we've had these, I'll just say, these catastrophic events that have humbled us or dragged us in a different direction. And the Civil War was one of those. But when we look at D.C., Congress had to regulate and control whatever it was they did. So Congress should have had an office of police, their municipal police force. They did not have the authority to create their own government. And so they could have had a District of Columbia office that would have taken care of infrastructure, those types of things. But to create a governor and to create what they did in the Organic Act, they literally abrogated, because now all laws were being shifted over to the District of Columbia in controlling the seat of government. We are far better off. As a matter of fact, as we look at it today, I think the empirical data only proves that when you amass a lot of control and a lot of power into one spot, it becomes the den of iniquity. Therefore, the best thing we can do, because we have technology, we can actually do this, we should be able to actually send everybody back to their homes and let congressmen work from their states, let senators, let's do everything virtual. And this way, when we entreat with people, do we really need to entreat with people in person? Then if so, then we should be able to create what I would call these, because if you look at, how many United States embassies do we have in the United States?
I don't.
We actually have quite a few. Los Angeles has an embassy. In other words, these are places where we actually have diplomatic relations for foreigners to come into the embassy, so they don't have to go all the way to D.C. I mean, a lot of people, where do they get, where did you get your passport? Where did you go to get your passport? Did you actually go and physically apply, or did you just do it on mail, by mail?
Nope, I went to the post office.
Okay, yeah, well, you had to get the photograph and the form and all of that. So you just mailed it in. I'm going to guess that there may be an embassy in Denver.
I think they sent it to Denver, actually.
Yeah, there you go. So they have these embassies, and it's just a matter of having the needful buildings. Remember, the federal government has the ability to have needful buildings. They don't have the need to own that land. And the fact that they're controlling and owning that land makes them property holders. And it empowers them. And this is why they want to be property holders of the United States, why they assume this. They don't have the legitimate authority to do this. They don't have the legitimate authority to own your forests, to own your minerals, to own these things. That's not in the Constitution. They don't have that authority. But they've assumed it because they've been able to get away with all of this stuff. So the fact is when we're looking at this concept of the exclusive legislation, the design was really to, because they couldn't fathom living in today's society, being able to travel around the world in just a few hours via, you know, supersonic flight. They couldn't fathom being able to literally talk live to somebody that's on the other side of the earth with a little bit of latency, a little bit, you know, like waiting for the response or something like that. But They had no idea what was ahead technology-wise. And we're, you know, 2.5 centuries beyond them now. So that being said, as we kind of look at what they were doing in D.C., they had to set it up to do what was appropriate at that point in time. And I point out, you know, people kind of forget. They just don't think about what life was like in those days. I have to remind people, if you were going to have a child, the typical home did not name their child because there was a good likelihood the child would die. So they had lots of kids. And it was common to just basically name the child the visitor, the guest, or what have you. They didn't name the child until it got to 1 or 2 years old, until they felt, okay, this is a keeper.
Really?
Yes. The child mortality rate, the infant mortality rate between 0 to 2 was pretty high. And so
I did not know that.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, if you read the John Adams and some of the biographies and so forth, and actually, when you really look at John Adams, because Abigail, every child that she had, she called it the visitor. And so she had lots of children. I want to say 4 or 5, I think, or 6. Anyway, she had quite a few kids, but they lost some. And they lived in an area of the United States that had the highest life expectancy for adults, but they still had a high infant mortality rate. That's just life. It was just life. It's just like they didn't have refrigeration.
I knew they had a high fertility rate, but I didn't know that they didn't name them.
Yes, because it was just really hard. I mean, you, when the father wanted to have a son, you know, carry his name, you know, he died. Let's name the next one the same. Name the next one until we get a keeper.
Yeah.
So that's why. When they really had, and it, like I said, it was just, these were common things because it was just a part of life. And they had lots of children because they needed work. And as a matter of fact, back in those days, if they were regulating child labor, they would go, who do you think you are? You're regulating? I can't have my kids out there at nine years of age to go, you know, milk the cows or do things on our farm. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Going hunting. My grandfather, you know, went hunting, and I don't think he was 10 years old yet. His father, just a quick story, his father took him out. You know, he said, hey, can I go hunting? And his dad said, well, I don't know. Let's see if you know how to handle a weapon. So they kind of walked out from the house, and he put a can down, and they walked out further from the house, and he handed him the rifle. He goes, show me if you can hit that can. And he looked at it, and he goes, well, if I shot at the can, and if I miss or ricochets, it could hit the house. And he goes, that's good enough for me. So he knew, and he was thinking about where he was making the shot and taking it and so forth. And that was good enough. At that age, Grandpa was off, you know, hunting and so forth. So the point is that the life that they lived was so different. They couldn't fathom having national campaigns where the president, these men would go around and actually campaign. That's why they created an elector system. So when we look at why and how they did things, some of these things were brilliant. And some of these things were just based on the necessity of the time. So when we look at D.C., the intent, as we went through the ratification debates, the only reason I'm actually making hay out of this is the one few, I should say, there are a few excerpts where they talk about this concept of exclusive legislation. They're being clear that they can't legislate against the state and those types of things, but the reality is that they weren't able to actually be subjugated. In this particular case where he says, if they actually become, you know, an accession or the home state assess and basically assents to giving them this land, they could create these stipulations. No, they can't. He's misspeaking. But the reality is, in this, they kind of dealt with this in the convention, as well as the, you know, the Constitutional Convention, as well as many other states, where they clearly stated the necessity of having this full autonomy. But Congress had to do it, that this could not be a state. They did not want the federal government to possess land to become land rich, because they knew if they had land and they could control land, that means that they could control us through that land, keep us off that land.
Right.
Because that's what they were doing in England. That's exactly what they were doing in Europe, is basically starving the people and basically limiting their access to the resources, because they controlled it all. This government was unlike those governments. This government couldn't control resources. Those were for the states to control. So anyway, let me just kind of put the lecture out, but I hope people start realizing that this concept of exclusive legislation was literally to allow them to govern themselves exclusively. So did they make prostitution legal? They could have done that, but they didn't, at least, you know, not in front of anybody, or they didn't, you know, create these human trafficking things, you know, way back then. They may have it now, but it's not something that they actually put on paper, right? I mean, if we could expose who did those things and how these things got created and how these people were behind human trafficking and prostitution and drugs, blah, 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 then, you know, we'd be going after those guys. I mean, they'd be shamed, right? But it's all being done in the dark rooms and the recesses where the power brokers work, you know, and so forth. So anyway, it doesn't mean evil won't do evil things, but the intent was to protect the government so they couldn't be harassed and they would be able to self-govern themselves, but that's it. It couldn't trickle out to everybody else. Now, remember, there's also this other thing about reciprocities. If a U.S. citizen travels from one state to another, their rights and privileges follow them. So if you go into D.C., those rights and privileges would follow them there as well. Anyway, let's go to the next one, which are the amendments, if I remember correctly, right? I think it's the amendments to the Constitution. Yep. Now, this is where they kind of talk about that, where they talk about making amendments, not the amendments that they're going to present, because that's down at the bottom. This is where they actually start talking about amendments. Go ahead.
Okay. It is true that by the Articles of Confederation, the consent of each state was necessary for any alteration. It is also true that the consent of 9 states renders the Constitution binding on them. The unhappy consequences of that unfortunate article in this confederation produced the necessity of this article in the Constitution. Everybody knows that through the peculiar obstinacy of Rhode Island, many great advantages were lost. Notwithstanding her weakness, she uniformly opposed every regulation for the benefit and honor of the Union at large. The other states were driven to the necessity of providing for their own security and welfare, without waiting for the consent of that little state. The deputies from 12 states unanimously concurred in opinion that the happiness of all America ought not to be sacrificed to the caprice and obstinacy of so inconsiderable a part.
Yeah, you kind of blurbed out, and that kind of happens in the evenings, I guess. The caprice and obstinacy of so inconsiderable a part. That's what she said. And so
Okay. That's
interesting, right? I mean, here again, Rhode Island was not, I mean, I would not want to, if I left Rhode Island to go travel, if I needed to do business in the other states, I would not say I'm from Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's kind of like, you know, later on they started creating names.
Saying you're from California.
Yes.
Just kidding.
Right. Well, later on they actually started talking about carpetbaggers, right? And you got that name as a traveling businessman. Oh, that's a carpetbagger. Well, you know, that probably before that, oh, that's a Rhode Islander. Anyway. So down a little further is another highlight. Go ahead.
The great principle is the safety of the people is the supreme law. Government was originally instituted for their welfare, and whatever may be its form, this ought to be its object. This is the fundamental principle on which our government is founded. In other countries, they suppose these the existence of and infer that if the sovereign violates his part of it, the people have a right to resist. If he does not, the government must remain unchanged unless the sovereign consents to an alteration. In America, our governments have been clearly created by the people themselves. The same authority that created can destroy, and the people may undoubtedly change the government, not because it is ill-exercised, but because they conceive another form will be more conducive to their welfare.
Can I stop you right there? Can I stop you right there? So, so folks, if you understand what he just said, we can actually change our government, but we don't change our government via revolution. And so if you don't think what's going on is really suiting us, and as a matter of fact, I would be, you know, probably leery in maybe a blue state. But I wouldn't be so leery in real red states like Wyoming, Dakotas, and so forth, where they kind of look and they realize how the federal government has basically permeated itself into the state and said, how do we get rid of this crap? And this is where it is right here, where the people can basically say, going back to the counties and having the county legislators stand up and say, we don't think that this state we created is actually serving our best interest anymore. We need to alter that constitution to get it focused again in actually taking care of what's in our best interest instead of bowing to Mordor on the Potomac. So this is where, you know, we have to start thinking that we actually have this power. This is baked in why counties matter most. I don't know how many times I repeat this idea that governments are instituted by we the people. And so we the people, if it's not happening, well, where's the fundamental government that we have to start shaking? What, when we look at the tree, you start at the root, right? The root being your family, your community, then the real root of government is your county. And you start shaking your county, and you start demanding that they actually fulfill their oath of office and start holding that, you know, state government accountable to hold the federal government accountable. And on and on. So anyway, go ahead and pick it back up from where you left off. Sorry.
Okay. I have stated the reasons for departing from the rigid article in the Confederation requiring a unanimous consent. We were compelled to do this or see our country ruined. In the matter of the dispensation, the convention, however, appeared to have acted with great prudence in copying the example of the Confederation in all other particulars of the greatest moment by authorizing 9 states to bind the whole. It is suggested, indeed, that though 10 states have adopted this new constitution, yet as they had no right to dissolve the old Articles of Confederation, these still subsist, and the old Union remains, of which we are a part.
There you go. So good luck with Rhode Island, because they're a part of it, too. In other words, you know, the last two states that had to coexist for 1 year was North Carolina and Rhode Island under the Articles of Confederation. Now, whether they even operated the Continental Congress, it's like a joke. I mean, it would have been North Carolina hosting and basically conducting all the business, and Rhode Island wouldn't be there because they weren't sending delegates. They typically weren't present. Anyway, okay, so now we just go a little bit further down to Mr. Bloodworth, and this is an anti-federalist comment regarding commerce.
Mr. Bloodworth observed that the first convention which met to consult on the necessary alterations of the Confederation so as to make it efficient and put the commerce of the United States on a better footing, not consisting of a sufficient number from the different states so as to authorize them to proceed, returned without affecting anything, but proposed that another convention should be called to have more extensive powers to alter and amend the Confederation. This proposition of that convention was warmly opposed in Congress. Mr. King from Massachusetts insisted on the impropriety of the measure and that the existing system ought to stand as it was. His arguments, he said, were that it might destroy the Confederation to propose alterations, that the unanimous consent of all the states was necessary to introduce those alterations which could not possibly be obtained, and that it would therefore be in vain to attempt it. He wondered how gentlemen came to entertain different opinions now. He declared he had listened with attention to the arguments of the gentlemen on the other side, and had endeavored to remove every kind of bias from his mind. Yet he had heard nothing of sufficient weight to induce him to alter his opinion. He was sorry that there was any division on that important occasion, and wished they could all go hand in hand.
Interesting, because bottom line, again, it's just like constantly picking at the scab that, you know, they were only supposed to make changes. They weren't supposed to do this. And how many times, even in North Carolina, how many times had we heard, just a few times already, every time he spoke, they'd come back and say, look, if we wouldn't have done this, then we would fail. Because bottom line, we have to get away from Rhode Island and their control of us. We needed to create a system that required a supermajority, not a, you know, 100%, not unanimity.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look today at the states, the reason the states are just rolling over and just basically becoming dirtier and nastier is because they're actually functioning as populations, mob rules, I should say, democracies. Because most all the states, it's 50% plus one to change the Constitution. So in other words, all you need are your population centers to dictate what they want you to do.
Yes.
And that's the same case in Colorado, which is why every state, when they actually go in to change their Constitution, they want to make sure that it requires two-thirds at a minimum of the counties to ratify, to change the Constitution, to give them more power or to take something out. So that way, there's no way mob rule can ever rule again. Because people would actually start to have to leave their population centers, they have to leave their culture, and so forth. And in the counties, these counties can actually create their own ruling as far as being involved in the county. Now, you may be able to vote in a federal election, you know, because the county can't change federal elections and running for office and so forth. But they can change the state laws to say, because state laws can be very stiff. You move in this county, before you vote in this county, you got to be here for 5 years. One thing for representation, but another thing for these other types of positions and so forth. So when we start looking at the opportunity that we've been given by the design of this system, we have the opportunity to actually make everything right. And with that, that's perfect timing. So when we come back, we'll dive down into some more topics. I believe there's a few more. Actually, they'll get into the Declarations of Rights, Amendments, exclusive legislation, and so forth. We're almost done. It looks like we probably have one more day of the North Carolina debates, and then we can start diving into other content. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.